Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Hey, daters. Are you sick of small talk and no date being planned? Well, I'm excited to introduce you to First Rounds on Me, a revolutionary dating app designed for modern singles who are fed up with the frustrations of today's dating scene. The app is all about actually helping you plan dates and build genuine connections. How so? Well, the only way you match with someone is by planning a date. Send a date, a time, and a location, and then the rest is up to you. Ready to go on real dates? You can get one free month of their premium subscription with code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R. Download First Rounds on Me using the link in the show notes and start building meaningful connections offline. Hello and welcome to Reimagining Love. I'm Dr. Alexandra Solomon. Relationships have the power to wound us and the power to heal us. As a clinical psychologist, author, and professor at Northwestern University, I've devoted my life to studying intimate partnerships and family dynamics. On Reimagining Love, I'm here to translate complex clinical topics into tools and takeaways that you can use in your relationships today. If you're ready to develop relational self-awareness and create vibrant and loving relationships with the people who matter most to you, you've come to the right place. I'm so glad that you're here. Hi there. Thank you for joining me here on another episode of Reimagining Love. Today's episode is inspired by one of my graduate students who has been a longtime fan, has read every book she's ever written, and she was like, you have to get this guest on your show. So we made it happen, and I'm so glad we did because I'm thrilled to introduce you to today's guest who is bursting with wisdom and generosity. It is Catherine Woodward Thomas. Catherine is the New York Times bestselling author of Conscious Uncoupling, 5 Steps to Living Happily Even After, and Calling in the One, 7 Weeks to Attract the Love of Your Life, as well as an award-winning, licensed marriage and family psychotherapist. Over the past 2 decades, Catherine has taught hundreds of thousands of people from all corners of the globe to create conscious, loving relationships. She also trains and certifies coaches in her techniques and provides ongoing supervision and development to a vibrant community of coaches from around the world. Today, Catherine is here to talk to us about conscious uncoupling, her powerful rebranding of breakups and divorce. Catherine reminds us that as our culture radically redefines relationships, the ability to truly choose a divorce or a separation is also radically new and therefore ripe for reframes and learning opportunities. Offering her own story of divorce, Catherine encourages us to bring a sense of generosity and intentionality to separation so that we can transform our relationships to our former partner and to ourselves. If you are working through a separation, my heart is with you, and no matter what, it's a painful process. But I hope and I trust and I believe that this conversation is going to be a supportive and encouraging space for you especially. Enjoy. Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today on the show.
It's lovely to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I would love to start us with the relational self-awareness question that we like to ask all of our guests. Are you ready for the relational self-awareness question?
I think so. Go for it.
All right. Well, I would love for you to talk about a growing edge that you're currently working on in one of your important relationships and what it has been teaching you these days.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about the difference between sacrifice and self-abandonment.
Oh.
Because I think, right?
Okay, bring it.
A lot of us have been working very hard to no longer self-abandon, to stay connected to our own feelings, deeply connected to our own needs, to express those to another person. One of the marks of health in relationship is the ability to say no without a fear of losing love, without a fear of being punished, to set those boundaries, and essentially to take care of ourselves. And I think our audience here is probably mostly women, and love the men that are here too. But, you know, we women traditionally have been valued for how much we give to other people. It's one of the ways that we kind of source our value. So a lot of us tend towards overgiving at the expense of ourselves, which is depleting to us. But inside of becoming so conscious of that, I know for myself, I've had to also grapple with being in an adult relationship with another human being for the long haul really does require sacrifice. And it's a gorgeous thing to give. It's beautiful. And so I've been thinking a lot about, well, what's the difference between the old way of being codependent or sourcing your value from giving or being overly giving at your own expense versus very real sacrifice for somebody where you're not getting your needs met for a while or you're not getting what you want. And I think that the beauty of a long-term relationship really lies in this kind of generosity. It's part of sacrifice, where you are expanding your circle of care beyond yourself. So you love yourself, but there's also an expansion of identity to include another person. And you're willing to prioritize their needs sometimes over your own because it's the right thing to do. And I think that we're now getting into the domain of true love. So that's what I've been thinking about with my partner lately.
I think it's so beautiful. You know, as I hear you talk through that discernment between sacrifice and self-abandonment, what I'm hearing you say is that it's not a question we can ask and answer solely on our own, right? We can only be teased apart in the context of the relationship. It can only be understood. It's a question that has to be contextualized within the relationship. Because if I'm sacrificing for you and you bear witness to it, appreciate it, look for opportunities, not tit for tat, but that you match me in that mindset or you witness what I'm doing, right? So is that fair to say that for you, this question has to be answered in a relational context rather than asked and answered solely as an individual question?
Yeah. I mean, where I got in my inquiry was that I think it has to do with what's motivating you, because it might look the same on the surface. I'm going to, you know, go of what I need for the sake of your needs. But underneath the surface, there's a lot going on. What's my motive? Am I sourcing my value from overgiving? Am I in some kind of an old story that I don't matter and your needs matter more than mine, which is going to go into codependence? But sacrifice is really based on a lot of self-love and the assessment of, do I have it to give? And what do I have to give? And being able to self-soothe or just, you know, delay your own gratification to actually show up for another human being is quite lovely. But I love what you're saying, because what you're adding is, you know, noticing the level of reciprocity and having healthy expectations of the other person, given who they are and where they're at. And I think this, you know, this has to do with making wise choices about which relationship to invest more of yourself into and give yourself over to, you know, and a lot of us get into trouble if we're going into relationships with people who don't actually have the capacity to love us back at the level that we actually need and deserve to have. So then it's going to go into an imbalanced place. So I appreciate your thoughts on it. That's not my case. Fortunately, I'm with a man who is, oh, I feel like I hit the love jackpot. Such manna from heaven for my soul.
I love that so much. I love that so much because you published Calling in the One. That was your first book in 2004 that was so popular and so treasured for so many years that you had to go back and update it and re-release it for all of us. But you came out first with Calling in the One. And then in 2015, you wrote a book called Conscious Uncoupling. So then now you're giving us a little, you know, a little whisper of your current journey, where you are in your relationship.
Yeah, I called in the next one, right?
You called in the next one. So tell us.
Well, it was such a blessing to have figured out. I mean, I'd been a person, this is about 20 years ago, right? So I'd been a person who'd been doing decades of inner development, really looking at the traumas of the past and grieving a lot of things that I didn't get and, you know, doing a lot of 12-step programs, meditations, workshops, anything I could think of, lots of psychotherapy. And yet, even though all of those things really saved my life, they were not necessarily changing the pattern in relationship, which was, for me, it was unavailable people. And married people in particular had almost a psychic connection with me. So if I would walk into a room, I would just attract, you know, the three married people in the room would come over and want to talk to me. And the 30 people, I'd be completely invisible.
You'd be like, well, I don't even see them.
Yeah. You know, those kind of patterns are really disheartening, particularly when we're working so hard. So one of the key teaching points that I work with in all of my work is that healing is the domain of the past, but transformation is actually the domain of the future.
Oof.
And what I mean by that is that there's missing development normally. If we're really stuck at a particular level, it's not just about going back and grieving or facing or reclaiming or all the things we do when we're healing trauma so that we unfreeze ourselves and we stop dissociating, get present in the room. But then transformation, if you say, I'm going to run a 26-mile marathon next spring, it's not just about, you know, visioning that or putting that on a vision board. You've got to get your sneakers on every morning. You've got to get up at 6. You got to start, you know, expanding your capacity to actually be strong enough to run that marathon. So when I say transformation's the domain of the future, what I discovered that kind of unleashed the whole teaching of Calling in the One was that if I wanted to break the pattern, at that point I knew, okay, there's no stone left unturned. From my childhood, there's no tears no longer shed. I know everything about, I mean, I actually got fired from a therapist once. She said, you know more about yourself than anyone I've ever met. You need to go. But, you know, it's great on one level, but on the other hand, I still didn't have the relationships I wanted, so I was confused initially.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what I learned in the transformational community is you've got to stand for an unreasonable, unprecedented future. I will be engaged by my 42nd birthday. It's actually the stand I took when I was 41. It was completely ridiculous. I've been trying to find that person for 20 years. I had no leg to stand on. I didn't know even what I was looking for. But I did one thing that was really wise. I didn't run out to try and find that person. I really went within and I looked to see all the areas that I would need to grow in order to become who I would need to be for that to happen. It was a different question. And it inspired and initiated growth that had been off my radar to engage. You know, we all kind of know that we're codependent or we have low self-esteem issues and blah, blah, blah. But to say, well, what does it look like to show up in a healthier way? And how can I do that with my best friend? And how can I do that with my boss? And how can I do that with my mother right now in service to becoming who I'd need to be? So anyway, I started to organize around that future. I did manifest this amazing breakthrough. I did call in an amazing, beautiful man. We were engaged before my 42nd birthday. We were married the next year. Then I gave birth to our daughter when I was 43. So I wrote Calling in the One. I had thousands of followers taking the 49-day process that I created to manifest this miracle. It's working for them. And then a decade in, Mark and I decided to divorce. And it was one of those moments, Alexander, where I just was absolutely certain I was going to just tank my whole career by making this move. And I could have stayed married I think all of us recognize that this is our one precious life. We want to live it authentically. So I took the plunge. I did get divorced. I didn't know it would lead to conscious uncoupling, but it did. If anyone says that my relationship to Mark failed, I say completely the opposite, because he inspired both of those books, which have blessed so many people.
So many people around the world.
When we did conscious uncoupling, we had a shared intention to make sure that our daughter had a happy childhood. And that was kind of the North Star that we aspired to. And we had both had parental alienation when we were young. He lost connection with his mother when he was just a baby. I lost connection with my father when I was 10. He gave up his parental rights because my mother hated him so much. So I'm very, very proud of conscious uncoupling, because it's kind of the completion of the biggest wounding of my own life. But then at some point I wanted to repartner. So that's what I did about 6 years later. And now I'm with a really beautiful man who I'm really just so grateful. But I'm with him in a way, going back to your first question, that's different with how I was in my first marriage. Because I was able to manifest that miracle, but what I didn't know in my first marriage was what it takes to actually stay very on the inside with each other. And I think it goes back to the neglect of my childhood. I had a very, very high level of neglect. So I didn't recognize the commitment that a relationship requires in terms of generating togetherness. And because we had a child pretty quickly, you know, it was very easy to do a parallel life where we're just kind of juggling childcare and jobs and, you know, all the stuff that we had responsibilities for. And I actually lost connection with him. And he was such a lovely person that I didn't notice that for several years, actually, until it was almost too late. Well, it was too late. I mean, you know, at that point, I suppose we could have gone back and done a ton of work to try and find each other again. But we just, you know, neither one of us felt like it would be a disaster to separate. And we both looked at what we cared most about. And it just seemed like the right choice to separate. So with Michael, my partner now, I'm learning from him, actually, because when I was visioning for Calling in the One again, I was visioning a man who'd had I'm in my 60s now, right? So I wanted a man who has had a long and happy marriage. I was visioning for a widower because I really wanted a man who knew how to love a woman.
Over time.
So I learned from him about how to stay on the inside, because he's always generating togetherness and we-ness in the relationship.
Beautiful. That you had identified the wounds of your past and how they were playing out, and how after a long history of neglect, togetherness was really challenging and confronting and confusing. I imagine that you felt that there was a kind of togetherness with Mark, and that there was a kind of togetherness, and it was not sustainable. You describe in Conscious Uncoupling that this was also an occupational hazard, that your deep commitment and orientation to self-growth and development meant that you continued to grow and grow and grow in ways that made the relationship not sustainable.
Well, I think, you know, when it came down to it, even though it looked on the surface that we had similar values, because he's very Buddhist and he cares about love and goodness. He's a very kind person. He practices kindness and forgiveness. And, you know, there's a lot of beautiful things that I admire about Mark. And his practice was to accept everything exactly as it was, period. And my practice was to always
vision
what it could be.
Vision. What else? But what might be possible here? What's the edge? Where might we stretch a bit?
We were just in two different universes.
Yeah, exhausting each other. And how beautiful that your daughter got to grow up with you and Mark both being truly living out your values. Then Alex got to find a way to figure out, okay, so where am I? Who am I? If both my parents are living anchored, aligned with their values, who do I get to be?
they say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Do you feel like you're at a crossroads in your love life? Maybe you are sick of modern dating or wondering if the person that you're with is your person. Whatever your situation, I have the perfect podcast for you. Dateable. Dateable is your insider's look into modern dating, hosted by Julie Krafcik and Yue Xu. Julie and Yue bring a sense of humor to their insightful explorations of all things dating, turning matches into actual dates, the psychology of relationships, red flags, attachment styles, and so much more. I am proud to have been a guest on their podcast 3 times. So if you're looking for a great starting point, check out my latest episode with them, When You're Ready and They're Not. I'll put a link at the bottom of the show notes. Wherever you start, this podcast is going to help you feel inspired to date differently and create a love life that works for you. Subscribe to Dateable wherever you get your podcasts. I was thinking about the Margaret Mead quote that you use, you know, kind of early in the book, Conscious Uncoupling, and you write that Margaret Mead has said, "I've been married 3 times and each marriage was successful." And that is what you are tireless about in your process of conscious uncoupling. You are tireless about helping us really transform individually and culturally this conflation we have of endings being failures.
It's so embedded in our consciousness, this happily ever after myth. And we all are covertly holding ourselves and each other accountable. And if one or both people live beyond the end of the marriage, then we automatically assume that that marriage was a failure, or not one or both. But if somebody doesn't die,
right,
we assume it to be a failure. And, you know, we're going to talk a good game and maybe we'll put on a good front for the community and we'll say, well, it's mutual and we bless each other. But inside, your heart is like carrying the burden of kind of where you're messed up, all the disappointments. You know, and there's always going to be disappointments and failed expectations. We do go into our unions with the best of intentions, particularly like you're standing at the altar pledging lifelong devotion. We don't make those commitments lightly. But it's very important for us to understand that the till death do us part of the marriage vows was created in the middle of the 16th century when the lifespan was 35 years of age. And the happily ever after story, the kind of archetypal story, which has us all really at the center of our souls and includes upward mobility and happiness forever, safety forever, that was actually originally created as a form of escapist literature, also in the 16th century, the end of the 16th century, in, believe it or not, Venice, Italy, which is still the romance capital of the world. And basically what was happening in Italy at the time that that myth was created was that there was a very locked in class structure where there was no upward mobility. And the people that were born into poverty were pretty much assured poverty for the rest of their lives, because there was actually a law in the books that a noble person could not marry a commoner. These were kind of, you know, there was no television, there was no Netflix of the day. This was the Netflix of the day. This was, you know, just filling people's hearts. There weren't many choices in life, but fortunately it was post-Renaissance time. So people were actually literate. You know, when I was divorcing Mark, I immediately collapsed into shame. And of course, that was probably even coupled further with the pressure of thousands of people looking to me as having the answer for, you know, the one person that you're going to call into your life. But I know enough to step back from my own assumptions, this muscle I've developed over the years, and to say, what's thinking me right now?
Oh, beautiful.
Right? What am I assuming is true right now? And I thought, well, I'm assuming that I've utterly failed. And I said, whose thought is that? Where does that come from? Because if I really measured that against what I was feeling, it wasn't such a black and white failure. Yes, there were failures and shortcomings, but there were also successes and wins. And there was also courage, and there was conviction, and there was integrity. So all of those things were mixed into it. And so I literally just started to research that happily ever after myth. And I think it's very important for us to all get into the habit of asking that question of ourselves. What's thinking me right now?
What's thinking me right now? What's thinking me right now? Because the thoughts feel like a reality, right? The phenomenological, the experience inside of oneself is that the thought is the reality. I should stay for my kids, you know, happily ever after. I'm failing. This is shameful. And you're asking, what is thinking me right now? And so many of the thoughts we have are the ones we've inherited. And you just talked us through the happily ever after. I mean, you just took that and unraveled it, right? That happily ever after was intended to capture an escapist fantasy in a moment in time.
Well, memes always come out of the conditions of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is changing very quickly. So we do have to remember that relationships are a moving train. And Stephanie Coons, the anthropologist for relationships, she's so brilliant. She wrote the book Marriage, A History. And in that book, she says relationships have changed more in the past 30 years than in the 3,000 years before. So we are quickly moving. I mean, even divorce that is possible for most of us today is a relatively new phenomenon.
That's right.
About 50 years old. In 1969, it began when Reagan signed no-fault divorce into law in California. Mostly, some people speculate, because his first wife accused him of abuse when he got divorced.
And
he was
I never knew that. Oh, my gosh.
It was the only way they could divorce. Infidelity, spousal abuse, it was pretty nasty. Some of the cultures that have really held out right till the end, Malta, for example, just passed a law that allows people to divorce within the last few years. So, we're coming out of a time where we have some pretty archaic ideas. Now, what is important to remember is that if you're getting divorced or you're breaking up from a significant relationship, your biology is not lined up yet with this very conscious way of moving forward, right? Your biology is still maybe stuck in the past 1,000 years ago, because 1,000 years ago, if we wandered away from our tribes, we would, pretty assuredly die. So we still feel like we're going to die.
Of course.
When someone leaves us, we go into fight, flight, freeze. It's one of the most traumatic things that people can go through.
Absolutely. And you don't put conscious uncoupling out there as a remedy for that, right? You can consciously uncouple and still feel pain. The process that you offer us, the 5-step process, does not eliminate the pain.
So let me bust the myth of Gwyneth and Chris a little bit. I mean, I don't know, I'm not on what's happening for them or their personal lives, but, they very fortunately used conscious uncoupling, kicked it into the lexicon, and made it look like it's just a very, glamorous, amicable divorce, some version of amicable divorce, and everybody's friends on the other end of it. That's not what I created it for. I created it, conscious uncoupling, for the individual who's devastated, who doesn't even recognize themselves because they're so angry and they want revenge and they can't sleep and they can't eat and they're obsessively cyber stalking someone outside of their character to do, where they're looking to get their life back and they're just kind of overwhelmed by these big emotions that are taking them over and taking them out in many ways. And at the same time, they're having to make very practical decisions like who gets the kids and where do we live and what are we going to do with the house? And, what are we doing with the retirement fund? And people do crazy things during divorce, during this period.
Unbelievable. Like, yes.
Unbelievable, crazy things.
Unbelievable to themselves, right? They are unbelievable to themselves as well as to their therapist and their best friend. And because of the pain you're talking about.
So severe. Yeah. It's so severe. And they're in such a state of imbalance. So to stay conscious during that period, to know what's happening for you, to be more in command of your emotions so that you can take actions that are aligned with your ethics rather than kind of the overwhelming tidal wave that you're experiencing emotionally. To be able to be self-responsible without moving into self-hatred, to use the breakup to actually grow yourself to the next level so that you can have faith that this will never happen again and that you will have better relationships moving forward. All those things are happening in the first three steps of conscious uncoupling. Only the last two steps that we're dealing with the other person. And when we're dealing with the other person, I'm not even saying you have to be friends, but if you have children, you have to have a clear field. You're not walking around with resentments. You're actually complete. You're at the point where you can wish the other person well, kind of let go, let God, you know, to each his own karma. You know, not mine to solve. I don't need to punish that person. You know, I'm grateful for the wisdom gained. You can really put the children first and be clear about that. You can make new agreements for the relationship. You can align your community up with not having to take sides, not having to fortify your own position by getting everyone to hate your partner, which is actually, you know, a form of psychic attack on that person, really, because we're all very connected and you can hear when people are hating on you, even if they're not talking to you directly. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that do a lot of damage to our children. This thing about staying together for the sake of the kids. I mean, it was Constance Ahrens in her wonderful book, The Good Divorce, which I think came out in the 90s. She was really kind of front runner, right, of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of studies. It's not the divorce of the parents. It's the unresolved ongoing conflict that damages kids. And she cited studies where they followed children who came from intact families, but high conflict families. And they showed the exact same symptoms that we associate with kids of divorce, you know, high truancy, high drug abuse, alcoholism, promiscuity, all the things we don't want for our children. So it's not so much, you know, staying together for the sake of the kids. I'll tell you a little private thing.
Then I have a private thing for you about Constance Ahrens. But you go first. You go.
Okay. You know, I had the courage to say, okay, Mark, I think we need to separate. I was thinking about it for a long time. But the one thing that was coming up is I didn't want to hurt our daughter. Right. I didn't want my daughter to come from a broken home. Ugh, right. And my daughter is such a little mystic that she turned to me at like the age of 7 and she said, "Mommy, why are you still with Daddy?"
Oh, wow.
Out of the blue.
Okay.
No conflict in your home. We never fought.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just was so shocked. It was like she was channeling. I said to her, "Sweetheart, you know, if I wasn't with Daddy, you'd have two different homes and two different bedrooms." And she said, "Oh, I don't mind at all."
Oh,
okay.
Like, well, if I don't have that constraint anymore, then what the heck am I going to do?
Okay, you tell me your story about Constance Ahrens.
I'll put a link in the show notes to some of her work because she just was such a trailblazer. And I remember being years ago at an American Family Therapy Academy roundtable with her. And I remember her talking about, you know, when you're looking kind of at the system during a divorce, how important it is to consider the idea as a therapist of bringing together the mom and the stepmom, you know, the women of the system. Mm-hmm. And I got so tearful because that was probably one of my largest sources of pain as a kid was the animosity between my mom and my stepmom and just my own struggle around who to be vis-a-vis these two all-powerful, almighty female figures in my life. And my gosh, if there had been somebody there who had been able to help them find a peace together, it would have been very different for myself and for my siblings as well.
Oh, completely different. Completely different. That's an amazing thing. I loved her. What a spirit. What a trailblazer she was.
100%.
Yeah. I had a client not long ago who was marrying a man who had 6 adult children. And he had a very hostile relationship with his former wife. They'd had a very bad divorce. She'd done some very unethical things. You know, those are hard to get over. And of course, you know, during his courtship, he told her about these things, and then she had bad feelings towards the former wife as well. And you think that because the children are adults, that this is not a big deal, but it actually is a big deal. Yeah. It's a really big deal. It creates a lack of consistency, a lack of grounding, a feeling of being kind of emotionally homeless to have that kind of break in your family. So I encouraged her to invite the woman to lunch and to befriend her. She took her to lunch. By the end of the lunch, they, you know, had a glass of wine together. They were laughing. They were talking about the things that they loved about their shared husband.
Right. They've got a big thing in common.
Mm-hmm. And they just created a different relationship. Well, that delighted the kids.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
The kids got so free. And then she started kind of pushing on her husband to go make amends and make it much more friendly for the kids. So everybody at some point started like sharing holidays, and it became one big happy family. And so she was, you know, forever just thanking me for encouraging her to have that lunch. She said, I never would have even thought to do that. Conscious uncoupling is about, let's evolve the story in a positive direction. And let's get out of these small boxes of what we think should be. And let's not be so stingy with our love.
And let's not have a limited vision, because I think therapists end up being as limited in their vision as the clients they serve, because we all have been socialized around this idea of a quote unquote broken family, or that when a family, you know, this idea of the binuclear family, is that Constance Ahrens again?
Yeah.
You know, the language, right? The language conveys something so powerful that, of course, a family doesn't stop being a family because two people have decided to divorce. And so when we, I think there's ways in which we all have participated in continuing that idea that there has to be animosity and separation and loyalty binds. And so what you did, you know, it wasn't, this husband may not ever know you and your work, but by one person going through a process of conscious uncoupling, she then had the power to shift something from her position by inviting the first wife to lunch. That changed, that rippled the entire system, the whole system.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I appreciate what you're pointing to, because in a conscious uncoupling, people always ask, well, what if I want to do it, but my, you know, soon to be yes. husband doesn't. And I say, it really just takes one person. And usually what happens when people are separating is the person who has the least amount of consciousness is in charge of the energy of how this is going to go.
That's right.
Hacking, and they're bad mouthing, and they're grabbing. And then the person who wants to do this well gets kind of, you know, drawn into the fight, brings out the worst in them. They're in reaction. So one of the things I teach in conscious uncoupling is how to hold your power in the face of someone who's misbehaving, and then how to actually seed a more generous culture between you, because you are creating a new culture. You know, each family is a culture. You have certain ways of relating that are particular to that family. And when you dissolve the structure of that relationship, you need to create a new culture. And you don't want the person who's the least conscious to be the one in charge of that process, particularly if there's kids. So in step 4, which is become a love alchemist of the conscious uncoupling, it's a 5-step process. In this particular step, I talk about this image of kintsugi, which is that Japanese art where you repair broken pottery with gold, making the repair, the gesture of repair actually validates the value of even the broken pottery, and it makes something even more beautiful on the other side. So that happens through acts of generosity, truthfully. And acts of sacrifice. So it's not a codependent giving, but it is where you are strong enough and visionary enough to seed a new culture, the possibility of building a new form of family. So that started actually with Mark. He was the one that gave me that idea. When we were sitting with a mediator, and we were going through all of our assets, and I'd written Calling in the One when I was married to Mark. And Mark made a lot of sacrifices, actually, for me to be able to do that, because our daughter was quite young, and he would take her for a whole weekend all by himself and never complain, so I could go to a hotel and just write. But when it came time to looking at that as an asset, the mediator said, you know, you're entitled to 10% of her royalties for the life of the product. And Mark just organically said, oh, I would never take that from Catherine. She worked so hard on that book. That's how I felt. I just felt like, oh my gosh. So that was a moment. These acts of generosity come in moments. You know, you can't always plan them. My act of generosity to him then was a few weeks later. We had just moved Mark into his own apartment, which meant that we were very stretched financially because you're going from one home to two homes. And he's in this new apartment. We're just making it work. And he calls me one day. He says, Catherine, I lost my job.
Oh, Lord.
And I go into this inner panic, like, oh my gosh, how are we going to make that work? Are we going to still pay child support? But I managed to not say anything. I just said something encouraging. I'm sure we'll figure it out. But I wrestled with it for the next few hours. And I came to the conclusion that there were probably 1,000 ways, if I was really creative, I'd probably think of 1,000 ways to make money, but there was only one father my daughter was ever going to have.
Oh.
So I picked up the phone and said, why don't you not pay child support while you're looking for another job? Now, that was really scary for me because I actually didn't see in that moment how I was going to make that work. But I just took a stand for it and I recognized the moment. And this is how we build a new form of family. You have to invest in that family. We understand that when we're getting married, we do marriage counseling. We know that when we're in the marriage, we have to build the relationship, build trust. You have to do that on the other side of a marriage too, if you want your children to be well. And one of the things that Constance Ahrens also pointed out is that what happens with children from broken homes where parents don't do this work and don't do the repair is they're in the fantasy that their kids are better off than they are. They think the kids are okay. But in some ways, you know, we're passing the burden of our unresolved resentments onto those children to work out the, you know, what's the Bible say? The sins of the fathers are visited upon the children. So as adults, you know, we want to actually, you know, be the ones who are going to do the repair so that we don't leave our children emotionally homeless. Because while we might bird nest, which is when you have one home and the parents rotate, you know, good idea. But if the parents are at war, it's not the house that's the warmth and safety. It's the relational field. So we have to learn how to do this. You know, one of the things I point out around the happily ever after myth is that we live in a time where statistically serial monogamy is the new norm.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all slated to have two or three significant relationships in our lifetime. That's just the norm. I'm not advocating. And, you know, our lifespan has doubled in the last 100 years. So that makes sense. We live in a mobile universe with a lot of options. Women are no longer economically dependent upon their men to survive for the most part. I mean, some of us choose to be economically dependent, and that's fine for a time. But for the most part, we live with options. So, you know, we have to, you know, find ways to separate that are not so unconscious that we're predisposed to do both in our biology and in our legal system.
You were talking before about the origin story of unconscious coupling was not, you know, the sort of Gwyneth Paltrow version of it, of the amicable breakup, but it really was for you to offer the heartbroken a path to wholeness. So I wonder now, as I'm thinking about, you know, this book has been with us now for, you know, seven, eight years.
Yeah.
I can imagine a reader picking it up and being like, oh, this is great. So we're going to do the really sweet, clean, wholesome breakup. And so I wonder if now you have a reader where you have to take them backwards into their pain, right? If those first three steps are really honoring pain, it's like your book is now almost solving for a different problem, right? Where you are, rather than meeting someone in their pain and taking them up out of it, I imagine there are some readers where they're ready to just be like smiley, happy, amicable. And you're saying, wait, before you do that, let's make sure that you really have sat with all of the facets and looked, you know, at all the elements of this and touched your pain so that your amicability you know, is on a solid foundation rather than just a kind of moral high ground, you know, or imagining of how it should be. Is that fair to say?
Usually that person won't come to a coach.
Mm-hmm. They think they're fine.
Right? So if you think about who's going to and hiring a coach, it's very often couples, and the person who's in that space is the one who's leaving. They care about that person. They want it to go well. They want that person to be okay. But, you know, there's a difference. There was Diane Vaughn wrote a book called Uncoupling. And she really did this great study around the difference between people who are leaving and people who are being left. And there's a big difference. And mostly it has to do with where one's identity is. Because the person who's actually doing the leaving has already been creating a life outside the relationship and an identity outside the relationship. It doesn't even mean that they're involved with anybody else or that they have some new romantic thing, but they have other interests. They're ready to move on. They've been practicing it for a lot internally. The person who's being left, it tends to be devastated and shocked. So you have people at all different levels, truthfully, coming into conscious uncoupling. If individuals are coming in, it's usually because they can't get over somebody, but they might not be in the really acute pain that step one addresses. But there may be in step two, which is about how to reclaim your power in your life, meaning how do you take responsibility for your part without slipping into shame or self-hatred or this, you know, underlying question of what the F is wrong with me that I keep doing this all over again. How do you actually self-reflect in a way that's growth-oriented and that's going to lead you to repair your own relationship with yourself so that you know you would never betray yourself in the ways that you gave yourself away in that relationship? You know, you're never going to make a barter like I'm going to overgive to get your approval or whatever that was. And restore integrity to yourself. So people are coming in there, or they're still stuck in what's called prolonged grief, complicated grief that does not go away, where you're kind of, you've rejoined the land of the living, but you notice that you're not dating. Or if you are dating, you're skittish. You don't let anybody come too close. You destabilize relationships if someone gets too close, or you're just like fine without love for the rest of your life. Thank you very much. Or you're still kind of, you know, dreaming about that person. You still feel bad about it. You're kind of stuck with this rock on your heart. It's kind of compressing your capacity to love. So those are people who maybe it's not as acute, but they see there's a prolonged grief. One of the things that I say prolonged grief is, and this is just from my own work with many, many, many people, thousands of people by now doing this process, is that to me, prolonged grief is when you get stuck in false meaning. I call the meaning that we're making in our bodies of the breakup, the I'm not enough collapse, or I'll always be alone collapse, or no one will ever love me collapse. I'll never get my needs met in love collapse. I am too much. Whatever that story is, I call that the source fracture story.
The source fracture, right.
It did not start with your partner. It started long before. And you made that meaning up when you were 4 years old or 2 years old. Or, you know, so we go back and we have to actually make more empowered meaning of the breakup in a way where you can be restored to your own integrity and your own dignity. So people do come in at different levels. I think, you know, as coaches of the work, sometimes I want to skip over. I train the people to go through the whole process in a way, because sometimes you think you're okay, but when you realize what step one offers, step two offers, step three offers, all of the steps offer a core skill that, had you known that skill when you were in that relationship, you might still be together.
Right. So part of it is holding tenderly to what we didn't know when we didn't know it.
Exactly. I didn't know that. Most of the mistakes we're making in relationship, it's like off our radar.
I mean, it's the thing that, you know, in the last 10 years, I've heard so many times. I was like, where was your work 10 years ago? Where was your work when I was 20? Where was, you know, like, that is just such a recurrent theme, right? Is when we decide to step into this self-work, we have got to be so gentle with ourselves for not knowing then what we begin to know now.
For sure. And a lot of times when people are unpacking like a relationship with someone who's like sociopathic or narcissistic, you know, what's my part? Well, it's hard to say what my part was a year ago because I was just trying to survive this onslaught of, you know, whatever was coming at me. And usually I go back to when you were first dating. Did you notice that it was all about them? What was the bargain you were making? You know, what worked for you about that? The riding of on someone's, you know, confidence coattails as a way to compensate for your own lack of confidence, where you didn't have to, or where you didn't have to be responsible for your life because somebody else was going to tell you how to live and what to do.
Absolutely. Right.
Right. And at that time, that looked like a good deal. So you made a bargain. So you almost have to go way back to the beginning on how you set the relationship up. And a lot of times it's really about making that first, there's two places where we set an intention for a positive possible future, because those who have a positive possible future, even when they're in the midst of a breakup, statistically do much better at recovery. So in the first step, we say, what are you going to use? This is a bottom. What are you going to do differently from now on? And you set a personal intention. From this moment forward, I will only have relationships where there is mutuality, where there is respect, with someone of good character who treats me well. So if you have rage, that's because you're reclaiming your right to something that you probably do want to take a stand for. From this moment forward, I will only be with people who treat me with respect, right? So there's some kind of intention for a positive future that you're going to create from this. The second intention is, what am I going to do with this relationship? Now, you might never want to speak to this person again. If this person was a sociopath and they did horrible things, you better not try and be a best friend to that person because they've already revealed their character. So what you want to do instead is, you might say, I'm going to hold this person like they were my catalyst. They were my dark guru. They woke me up to my true value. Finally, let me see the consequences of that codependent behavior. So we're looking for a way to create a positive possible future. I'm not going to hate on that person, live and let live. But I am, if this is a family member and I have children with this person, might be our children have a happy childhood, we're great co-parents, right? So you're looking to the future and you're working backwards from there. What's it going to take? Who will I need to be? And mostly you're going to be outgrowing who you were when you created that relationship and become a higher, better version of yourself.
It's wholly unsurprising that that would be, you know, a through line of your work, is having somebody imagine their positive possible future. Cause that's who you are, right? You are a visionary. That is what you do in your own. It's how you move through the world. And so, of course, I love that you start with the vision. You help somebody identify their vision and work back from there. So as we move towards closing, Catherine, what is your vision for the next frontier of intimate partnerships? Where are we going?
You know, I'm actually creating something called future focused therapy right now.
Of course you are. Of course you are.
It's a greater focus on identifying the missing development that would allow us to fulfill our deepest desires, that would equip us to step into and co-create and generate the lives that we're wanting to live and the relationship that we're wanting to live. I do follow wonderful teachers that, you know, certainly that most of us know about and follow. One person who's a little off the radar, who I like to mention a lot, is Polly Young Eisendrath. She has a book called Love Between Equals that she is quite brilliant in what she's identifying. And she really talks about the skills, the inner skills, the intra capacity and the inter capacity skills that we need to be able to differentiate from each other. So it's interesting because she really distinguishes the difference between kind of the holy grail of secure attachment that we're all kind of aspiring to, and the ability to tolerate the differences between our partner, to engage the differences in a really successful way that deepens true intimacy and true love. She distinguishes that the enemy of love is not so much hatred or even indifference, but she says it's idealization.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a stage where we move from idealization and into the capacity to truly see the other and to offer and extend our love for two people for exactly who they are and exactly who they're not. And that's really when relationship begins, is when the idealization starts to end.
Wonderful. Wonderful. You know, you described your partner as manna from heaven, and I think that you are manna from heaven. I just have loved getting to spend this time with you. There's so much that you're talking about that speaks to my heart. Of course, I want to like stop recording now and just nerd out on all of our favorite teachers and, you know, like just go totally therapist to therapist with you. But I think you've given, I'm just imagining our listeners just soaking up all of what you have offered us today. We will obviously have the links to your book and your website. And I know you've got a robust coaching program. Coaches are available who've been trained by you and in your method. But tell us, what are your leading edges right now? What are you working on? What do you want us to know about how to keep deepening our relationship with you?
Well, for years, I've been doing almost all these separate courses, right? I do a coach training here, and then I'll do a conscious uncoupling program or calling in the one program. And that's been delicious. And I've had the privilege of working with a lot of people in that way. But I've always felt like we need to all stay together, particularly with the escalating crises of the world right now. Those of us who are practicing kindness, practicing love, expanding our capacity to love and be loved, we're needing to up our game. So we're launching a membership program that we're calling Manifest the Miraculous Membership Program. We're offering it for free, and it's ongoing development. So I'll be with people every month sharing a brand new skill and capacity and practice on how they can engage with the communities around them to expand their circle of care and learn how to be, you know, even a brighter light. And so that's what I'm excited about launching right now.
That just feels, it feels like a wonderful extension of, you know, your work is so, it's so deeply internal and it's so relational. And so I could just imagine that doing this work in community, this like community level of healing and learning and growing together is going to be just really potent. So that's exciting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine, for joining me. If you want to connect with Catherine or learn more about her books and all of the good work that she's doing around conscious uncoupling and calling in the one, please visit all the links in the show notes. And as always, feel free to send me your reflections and your questions that emerged from this episode. Email me at info@dralexandrasolomon.com or submit a question through the form linked in the show notes. And until next time, be well. Reimagining Love is produced and edited by Emily Reeves. Our theme music was composed by Slade Warnkin. Do you have a relationship question that you want answered on the show? Visit reimagininglove.com to send in a written or audio question. Questions can be about intimate partnerships, family relationships, friendships, you name it. If you're looking for more love and relationship content, you can find me on Instagram at dr.alexandra.solomon or visit my website, dralexandrasolomon.com, where you'll find my blog as well as the Intimate Relationships 101 e-course based off of the popular class I teach at Northwestern University. Thank you for listening and see you next week here on Reimagining Love.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.